Okay, it's a pleasure to have Frances Champagne here this morning. Frances got her undergraduate degree in psychology at Queen's College, Queen's University in Canada. She's originally Canadian, and you can hear a bit of a Canadian Toronto twang as she speaks. She then went on to get a master's of science in psychiatry at McGill, and then did postdoctoral training, postdoctoral work at Cambridge University before she came here as a member of the psychology faculty. I first heard Frances when she spoke at a National Academy of Sciences, National Institute of Medicine symposium several years ago, and was bowled over by the epigenetic studies that she was doing on how environment and experience influences brain development. And she will I hope all of you have read the lovely papers that she gave us to read about epigenetics and about the kinds of studies she does. But if you looked at the New York Times on Sunday, you saw there was an editorial on the change in the social, or proposed changes in the social sciences, and how the author, a Yale professor, said that we need the same kind of revolution in the social sciences and behavioral sciences that we've now had in the biological, medical, and physical sciences, and that's ongoing. That is, the influence of genetics on every area of human activity becomes more and more apparent. And the influence of environment and experience is indeed placed into our genomes in ways that Frances will tell us about this morning. So it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Okay, great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And what I'm going to do is walk you through epigenetics and how we're currently thinking about the role of epigenetic factors in brain development, and also hopefully near the end talk about the transmission of traits over generations and how epigenetics might enlighten our understanding of how inheritance works. And do feel free to interrupt if you have any questions throughout the talk, and I'd be very happy to clarify anything that I've gone over. So my interest in epigenetics really stems from a kind of a very global interest in the origins of our uniqueness. So why are we different from each other in terms of our behavior, our personality, certainly our disease risk? Even identical twins do not have similar disease risk. Schizophrenia, if you have a monozygotic twin, your chance of being schizophrenic, if your twin is schizophrenic, is actually less than 50%. So there's a lot going on in terms of variation that might account for our unique traits beyond simple genetics. However, our kind of conceptualization of what drives our unique traits, what makes us unique, really comes from the debate over nature versus nurture. Are we unique because of our genes, our variants in our gene sequences, or are we unique because of the unique experiences that we have across our lifespan? And I would say that one of the take-home messages from today, of course, is that there is not really either or, right? So we have genes, they are important. We have experiences, they are important. It is, in fact, not possible in any meaningful way to quantify the relative contribution of either of these two factors because nature and nurture work together. Our character, our personality, and our behavior are a product of the interaction between these two influences. Now, when it comes to thinking about how DNA can lead to the shaping of our brain and behavior, we have some degree of influence, although I would say that this is progressing rapidly with the advent of new and evolving molecular tools to study the way DNA works and the way DNA can change flexibly. When it comes to nurture, we don't necessarily know as much, although we're certainly gaining some expertise, but we know there is certainly something beyond genetic information that can shape characteristics. And I'm going to use this as an example of that phenomenon. So if you think of your body, all your cells have the same DNA, exact same DNA. So your neurons have the same DNA sequence as your skin cells and your hair cells and your muscle cells. But clearly these cells all have very, very different functions, very different characters of their own. And that character allows them to function in their unique way. So neurons are very different from blood cells, are very different from muscle cells in terms of their character, despite having the exact same DNA. So there is something more going on than just the just genetics when it comes to shaping character, shaping unique phenotypes or characters. We also know, though they're kind of the basic of genetics is to explain our unique traits, we also know that environmental experiences can do this as well. So our brain, our physiology and behavior can be very substantially shaped by early environmental experiences. So our nurture can have a long-term effect on our brain and behavior. And I'm going to focus on early environmental experiences, although, and I won't be able to talk about this today, experiences across the lifespan can lead to long-term changes. So it's not like everything shuts down. I'll talk a little bit about critical periods at some point. But it's not that we can't change later on. It's a little bit more difficult to change because our brain is changing and growing less rapidly as we age. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example of the kind of phenomenons that are studied when we're thinking about the effects of early life experiences on the brain. So prenatal development is a period where the brain is rapidly dividing. The cells in the brain are rapidly dividing. This is a window in which any kind of experience can have a profound impact on the brain. And so stress, exposure to toxins, exposure to alcohol, these can lead to very, very long-term and profound changes in the brain. And one of the areas that I'm going to talk about in the context of epigenetics is prenatal stress. And this is a topic that is being studied much more in humans now, although we can't go around stressing pregnant women. Unfortunately, there are a lot of stressors out there to which pregnant women can be exposed. And In most instances, those stresses are associated with a lot of other lifestyle factors. Sometimes there can be events that are exposing individuals randomly to stress who normally wouldn't be exposed to that, such as natural disasters, for example. Now, when mothers experience stress during their pregnancy, there are various outcomes in the fetuses that can be reliably predicted by that stressor. So risk of prematurity and lower birth weight are very commonly seen. These, in and of themselves, can lead to altered brain changes in the brain. And as a consequence of a maternal stress, we can see long-term increases in stress responses of the offspring who've been exposed to stress, and increased risk of depression and anxiety later on in life. So epidemiological studies in humans suggest that this is quite a long-term effect. And this is generally referred to as programming of the fetal brain or stress programming. So mothers experience stress, it programs the fetal brain to be more stressed in response to a variety of later life experiences. And of course, the more stressed you are, the more reactive you are to stressors, the more risk you're going to be for a number of forms of psychopathology. Okay, and of course, our sensitivity to the environment doesn't stop there. Variation in postnatal maternal care, which will be another theme that I'm going to talk about today, can also exert long-term changes in the brain. And certainly across species, even in little laboratory animals, there is wide variation in the way in which mothers interact with their infants, okay? So we see this in humans, we see this in primates, we see this in rodents, we see it in almost every species that you look at. There is variation in the way the mothers interact with the offspring, and that can lead to variation in brain and behavior. Of course, we can also deprive individuals of that early life mother-infant interaction or any kind of parental interaction. That can lead to variation in brain and behavior as well in a very profound way. But you don't even have to manipulate it. It's simply the variation exists, and that variation can lead to variation in the brain. Okay, so environment does indeed affect the brain. The question is, how does this occur? So as I said, we know a little bit about how nature or DNA can exert changes in the brain. How does the environment achieve, in a sense, very similar outcomes? And that is what has led myself and many other researchers in the field to explore epigenetics, which is really about understanding how DNA works. So in order to understand nurture, we actually have to go back and understand how nature works. So one of the analogies that I find very useful when thinking about epigenetics is to think about DNA as books in a library, right? Plenty of potential, lots of information stored in those books, but if you don't read them, that information never comes into being, right? It's stored there, it's in a sense a latent form, it's hidden, but it has to be activated, and there's an active process of taking that information and making it available that is true of books, but is also true of our DNA. Okay. Now, I'm going to walk you through kind of the key molecular, cellular molecular changes that I'm going to refer to primarily when I'm talking about epigenetics. Epigenetics is becoming broader and broader in what it refers to, but I'll kind of boil it down to a few simple molecular changes within the DNA. So a reality of our DNA is that it has to be packed into a very, very small space within our cells. There's a lot of it. And in order to pack it, we have to condense it. And DNA, when it's in a condensed form, is not very available, right? It's like a book that can't be read because it's stored somewhere that that is inaccessible. So DNA has to become available and unwrapped from this very, very dense structure in order to become easier to read and accessible to exert a biological change. Now, there are a number of processes changes around the DNA that will change the likelihood that DNA can be read or not. And I'll walk you through those. So here's a schematic. So blue, our blue line here is our DNA. And DNA, when it's stored within the nucleus of the cell, is wrapped around histone proteins, right? And it seems a little illogical, but the histone proteins are there to allow the DNA to be condensed in the smallest space possible. So you actually add proteins to make the DNA much more dense in its compactness. So these histone proteins form a little cluster, and the DNA wraps around those histone proteins, and that allows the clustering within the cell. Now, those histones are proteins, and they have little tails. So these are these histone protein tails that can dynamically interact with the DNA directly, right? So they, and I'll go through a little bit of that in a moment. Okay, so we have histones, we have DNA, and we have histone tails. Gene expression, the reading of DNA and the making of this potential into something that's realized into proteins, into mRNA, into proteins, requires the unraveling of the DNA from these histones. Okay, so we have our histones, but now the DNA is pulling away from those histones, and that makes it accessible to transcription factors, which are factors, proteins, that bind directly onto the DNA and initiate the reading of the DNA through gene transcription. So RNA polymerase is our key enzyme. It needs to be able to bind to the DNA. If it can't do that because the DNA is so condensed, you're not going to get active genes. The genes will stay in a very silent form. Okay, so then the question is, what can get that DNA unwrapped? Well, or prevent it from being wrapped. So one factor that can change the likelihood that the DNA can come away from those histones is DNA methylation. So this is a chemical process whereby a methyl group becomes bound directly on to one of the cytosine nucleotides within the DNA sequence. We have our four base pairs. Cytosine can become 5-methylcytosine. That's when you add a methyl chemical to the cytosine. And that's achieved through an enzyme called DNA methyltransferase. So it's a basic chemical reaction where you've added a chemical group, but of course you've added it to a part of our biology that's so incredibly important for the function of our biology. And so those 5-methylcytosines are now not mutated, but they're not very accessible, right? So they're there, but now they've got a methyl group on it, and that makes it almost impossible for those RNA polymerase to bind to the DNA. So this is one way to reduce accessibility of the DNA. You've clumped a lot of proteins and chemicals around the DNA, and now it's less accessible. Now, one thing I'll mention before we go to the next summary slide is that when DNA methylation occurs, so when you get these methyl groups bound onto the DNA, often that will change the configuration of these little histone tails so that they'll clump very tightly around the DNA. Okay? So normally, DNA is a very negatively charged molecule, and these histone tails are also very negatively charged, and like charges repel each other. However, if we add some chemicals to these histone tails and they become more positively charged, they will hug very tightly on the DNA and make it almost impossible to access. So DNA methylation is one way that we can silence DNA. We've got lots of DNA, and it can potentially do something, but if it's methylated, then it can't because it's not accessible anymore. Now, that kind of highlights two epigenetic processes which are becoming more appreciated as important mechanisms for understanding how the environment can control outcomes. So we have our chromosome, we have our chromatin with our little histone proteins and our DNA wrapped around those histones. We have histone modifications to those tails. So you can add all sorts of chemicals to the histone tails, acetyl groups, methyl groups, phosphate groups, and that can change the polarity of the tails, either making them repel from the DNA or come closer to the DNA. And then we have the process of DNA methylation, where we have methyl groups bound to the DNA. So overall, what all of these achieve is a turning on or turning off on DNA. We can add methyl groups, silence DNA, we can take them off and make the DNA more accessible. We can change those histone tails, make them repel away from the DNA. That will make the DNA more accessible as well. So there's ways to flexibly alter how likely DNA will be accessible to transcription.
When you use the terminology, we can, does that imply that humans do this or that various environmental factors can lead?
I'm saying we as in there's a process available to do this, right? So we have kind of evolved a biological way of controlling our genes in very dynamic ways. Okay, now I'm going to highlight another feature of DNA methylation, which I find very interesting and I think will be relevant when we get to the end talking about inheritance. So we always think about our DNA as being heritable, right? We inherit our DNA from our parents. Our cells, when they're dividing, pass on reliably their DNA to their daughter cells. And this is, of course, incredibly important because we wouldn't want too many changes occurring. But what's also important to note is that DNA methylation patterns are also heritable, right? When cells divide, they can pass on their DNA methylation pattern across generations. So I'll show you how that works. So here we've got our cell and our little green squiggle of DNA, and there's two methyl groups bound to that DNA. When that cell divides, it'll copy its DNA reliably. It'll also copy the DNA methylation pattern reliably. Both are important in creating the character of the cell. Now, we can also have a process what's called de novo methylation. And de novo methylation is really kind of the core of what I'll be talking about, because that's when we add, all of a sudden, we add a new methyl group. So we've changed the second cell here, and we've added a new methyl group to that DNA. Importantly, that will change the character of that cell, because that's what DNA methylation does. It changes which genes are active. Now, certain genes that can be active in this cell are not active in the second cell, and so that'll change, create differences between them. And importantly, when those cells divide, they will pass on both their DNA and their DNA methylation pattern. Now, this process is central to our development. If we could not do this, we would not survive beyond very, very early embryonic stages, because it is this process that creates the differences between different cell types, right? So our neurons are different from our blood cells and our muscle cells because of their unique DNA methylation patterns. They have the same DNA, but they have a unique DNA methylation pattern. And as the cells are dividing during the early stages of development, they slowly kind of accrue this unique DNA methylation characteristic that makes them one cell line of cells diverge from another line of cells. And, you know, although I won't talk about this today, one strategy that's now possible is to take cells that have kind of differentiated, developed some character, use epigenetic therapies, and bring them back into an earlier phase of their development. So make them stem cells, in a sense, which is very exciting. Okay, so our cells are genetically identical, but epigenetically dissimilar. And so epigenetics, then, I've kind of highlighted a couple of molecular aspects of epigenetics, but generally it's the study of those factors that alter whether the DNA will be expressed without altering the underlying DNA sequence. So we're not changing the DNA. Those cytosines are still cytosines. When the DNA replicates, they're still read as cytosines. But now there are factors clustering around the DNA that are altering the gene activity. So these are factors that change the likelihood that a book will be read. So there are many factors you can think of in a library, in the architecture of a library, that will make one book more likely to be read than another. And our cells function and our DNA functions in very much a similar way. Okay. The actual term epigenetics actually predates a lot of our current understanding of genetics, and so had not really the kind of molecular tone that it does today. And in fact, you know, within the people studying epigenetics, there's heated debates over the use of this term, which is quite amusing, because a lot of us come from a developmental perspective. And Conrad Waddington was a developmental biologist, and he coined the term epigenetics because he was interested in kind of forwarding the concept that development is a dynamic process, that we start as this little ball at the top of this hill, and as we go through life and through our experiences, we come to different endpoints. So a ball may roll down this hill or it may roll down this hill. And each of those are different developmental trajectories. And so he talked about the interaction between genes and their products and this dynamic process through which which development occurred. And this is really kind of a reaction to the preformatist view that we all have this genetic information, and we are completely a product of that information. So he liked to highlight the fact that there's this dynamic process, and that even with the same genetic information, we can come to very different endpoints. However, a lot of people come to the term epigenetics from a more genetic perspective, and so they view the term in a very different way. But we're going to talk about it more from a developmental perspective today. Okay, so that gives you a little bit of an idea of how epigenetics works at a molecular level. Now the question is, how can these epigenetic changes be shaped by our experiences? And it turns out that there are a lot of experiences occurring across the lifespan that can induce epigenetic changes, changes in DNA methylation, changes in histones. And so instead of having nature versus nature, it's really that our nature is altered by our nurture. Our experiences shape what aspects of our DNA become active. And it is only through that shaping that environmental effects become realized, that our environment comes to have a biological effect. So this is what I mean when I talk about this kind of constant interplay between nature and nurture. Okay. Now, that moves us from kind of a very molecular, cellular perspective to a broader perspective of epigenetics. And I talked about how different cell types with the same DNA could come to very different endpoints. Identical twins can similarly come to different, very, very different phenotypes. Identical twins can be very similar, But they are not identical, typically, in phenotype. There are differences in disease risk and so on. And studies looking at the epigenetics of twins are increasing and giving some really great insights into what is driving the difference between twins. And so twins, when they're very young, have obviously identical DNA, monozygotic twins anyway, and they also have very, very similar epigenetic profiles. So that if you look at the DNA methylation patterns in their genomes, they're going to be very similar when they're young. When twins are older, they have very dissimilar epigenetic patterns, right? So their DNA methylation patterns are very different as they age. And this has led to the hypothesis that epigenetic variation, changes in DNA methylation, emerges across the lifespan in response to our unique experiences. So what makes one twin's epigenome different from another is their unique experiences. And it's becoming clear that those experiences can even start during the prenatal time point that drive the divergence in character. Okay, so I'm going to go through a few examples on how prenatal and postnatal experiences can lead to variation in brain behavior through these epigenetic processes, and end with a discussion of our current thinking on how this affects the transmission of traits over generations, which is typically the domain of genetics. But I think as molecular biology advances and our theoretical models advance, we're getting more broad in our conceptualization of what it means to transmit traits and how that can be achieved. So the general hypothesis of the studies is kind of outlined here. So we have prenatal and postnatal experiences, which are going to be focused today, but as I mentioned, there's experiences beyond this time point. Certainly any kind of learning experience can induce an epigenetic change that can have profound long-term effects. But these experiences lead to epigenetic variation. That epigenetic variation leads to changes in gene activity. The changes in gene activity within the brain lead to altered neurodevelopment. And when you have altered neurodevelopment, you're going to have a number of behavioral consequences of that altered neurodevelopment. So changes in stress, cognition, social reproductive behavior, and the list goes on. Okay, so let's go back to prenatal programming of stress. So I also had a baby recently, so you know all of these kind of maternal and prenatal programming effects are close to my mind. And certainly, as I mentioned, stress has been shown in both animals and humans, and there's accumulating data suggesting that it has long-term effects and can increase risk of psychopathology. However, there are buffers in place, right? So women, when they're pregnant, actually have very, very high levels of stress hormones, right? They may not see more stress, but their actual levels of stress hormone are very high. And they're high because fetal lung development is dependent on stress hormones. So the more stress hormones you have, the more accelerated fetal lung development is. And in fact, the elevations in stress hormones predict the timing of birth because they predict how well the lungs are developing. Because, you know, having a stressed brain, you can live with having an inability to breathe is going to be a very big problem. So having stress hormones exposure during pregnancy has all these bad long-term effects, but it can enhance lung development. However, there is an enzyme within the placenta, so that's the barrier between the mother and the fetal compartment during pregnancy. There's an enzyme there that inactivates most of the maternal cortisol, because you want to have some to promote lung development, but you don't want to have it all, because otherwise your brain's going to be completely stressed, and it could lead to neurodegenerative disorders later on in life. So we have this enzyme, 11-beta-HSD2. And it's a very important enzyme because it takes most of these stress hormones and it inactivates them so that they can't have these stress programming effects. And we've been very interested in this enzyme and the activity of the gene that encodes for this enzyme, because that's going to be a very important variable when predicting how much stress will affect the developing brain. So we exposed females to stress not in humans, obviously, but this is a study in laboratory rats that we're doing in conjunction with some epidemiological studies in humans, where we took pregnant female rats and we exposed them to stress, and we took their placentas and we looked at the level of DNA methylation within the gene encoding for this 11-beta-HSD2 enzyme. And so we've got two groups. So this is the actual sequence of the gene. So that's what you're seeing now. So the nucleotide sequence of the 11-beta-HSD2 gene, and we have offspring exposed to in utero stress or offspring not exposed. And if we look at the DNA methylation within the placenta, what we find is if females have been exposed to stress, what happens is that gene becomes epigenetically silent, right? So we add all these methyl groups to the gene. Now it can't be expressed. Whereas if you don't have stress, there's plenty of that enzyme. It's the gene is active and you have lots of 11-beta-HSD2. So that means these mothers are experiencing more stress. So they've got elevated levels of stress hormone, and the enzyme that should be buffering the fetus from these stress hormone levels is inactivated. So you've got even more stress hormones crossing to affect the fetal brain. And so we're currently looking at human placentas to see whether this extends beyond this gene to affect other epigenetic silencing of other genes within the placenta. Okay, another exposure that can occur during prenatal development is exposure to toxins. And lucky for us, we're exposed to lots of toxins, so there's plenty to study. One of the toxins that we've been working with is bisphenol A, which perhaps many of you have heard about. Bisphenol A is something that we get ubiquitous exposure to. So all of us probably have measurable levels of bisphenol A in our bloodstream. And that's because bisphenol A is in plastic. It's used in the manufacture of plastic. And though it was assumed that it wouldn't leach out into to the contents of those plastic items, in fact, it is. So we drink out of plastic bottles. Those liquids or foods contain bisphenol A. Grocery store receipts that are printed on thermal paper have bisphenol A on the surface, so when you touch them, you actually absorb some of the bisphenol A. And this has got people a little bit worried, because being exposed to a chemical like this, which we know to be an endocrine disruptor, so it disrupts our endocrine signaling, is a bit of a concern. The question is whether the levels we're being exposed to, which are, you know, relatively low, are enough to induce long-term changes in brain and behavior and health. Okay, so this is work I've been doing with some people just located a few blocks from here at the School of Public Health, and they're the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. So for years now, they have been studying various pollutants in New York and how they affect brain development. And so the focus primarily has been on prenatal exposure. So, for example, they've been looking at car exhaust fumes, and they've got women who wear backpacks to measure their air quality during pregnancy, and then they do neuroimaging studies to see the brain development in the kids, and it's very, very disturbing findings. And so they've moved on to bisphenol A, which of course everyone's being exposed to. And the hypothesis that they wanted to test was whether prenatal exposure to bisphenol A leads to changes, epigenetic changes, whether this leads to changes in gene expression, and this is the consequence of this altered gene expression is neurodevelopmental, metabolic, immune, and immune outcomes. So there's some suggestion that increased obesity rates might be linked to our exposure to bisphenol A, amongst other endocrine disruptors during fetal development. Increased asthma has also been attributed to prenatal exposure. And I'm going to use this study as a way to kind of highlight the theme of planning and carrying out investigations, just to show kind of the logic of how we went about putting this study together and the various considerations that we had when actually conducting the research. So when I first came to Columbia, the group heading the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health had been looking at the question of how bisphenol A affects neurodevelopment by collecting urine samples from women while they're pregnant, and then seeing how those what those predict in terms of their children's outcomes. Okay, so what they found, this is just kind of a brief summary, is a sex-specific effect. And that's not too surprising, because whenever you disrupt the endocrine system, you're going to have a different effect in males than in females, because we have a completely different endocrine system. Now, what they found is if the offspring were boys, high prenatal BPA exposure was associated with increased behavioral problems. And so they used questionnaire data to assess the children's behavior, and particularly they found higher emotional reactivity on these measures and higher aggressive behaviors. In girls, they actually found lower behavioral problems as a function of high BPA exposure. So that's the sex-specific effect. You've got increased problems in boys and actually decreased problems in girls, and particularly they had reduced anxious, depressed, and aggressive behavior if they had high prenatal exposure to BPA.
How did they measure high BPA?
They took urine samples from the pregnant women and then took out measured the high and low, which isn't a great measure because what you pee out is not necessarily what you have in, but that's a debate for the CDC to settle. Okay. So the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health had been doing these studies, and it's always very exciting when you can show something in humans. But unfortunately, it's never causal, right? Because we're not exposing people to BPA, because that would be completely unethical. And they wanted someone to do some parallel studies in an animal model so that we could say, yes, in fact, if we take animals and we expose them to the levels of BPA that we're seeing in our humans, we get long-term effects as well. And so they contacted me and they said, you know, can we put a study together? And the key with putting something like this together, and a lot of my work now is part of kind of human-animal lab collaborations, is to figure out what question we're trying to address in the humans, and then try to model that in our animal models. So what we did was took mice. So we're going to use mice for these experiments. And we're going to expose them to BPA throughout pregnancy. Now, interesting questions can come from saying, well, is it important that the exposure occurs early in pregnancy or later in pregnancy? But that's actually not the question that we're trying to get at. And to be honest, the women, the human mothers in our study, are having constant exposure. It's not an acute exposure at one time in pregnancy like a stressor might be. But, you know, they're drinking from plastic bottles or touching grocery receipts throughout their pregnancy, and so you're getting fairly constant exposure. So, you know, for those of you not well versed in the reproductive cycle of rodents, they have about a 21-day pregnancy, right? So we treated them for 21 days, or actually about 19, I think, with BPA. They gave birth, and we assessed mother-infant interactions between the mothers and the pups. And I'm going to highlight why that's important. But almost every study that we do, if we have a prenatal exposure, we measure postnatal maternal care. Because often if you do something to a mother during the prenatal period, the effects persist in terms of her behavior towards her offspring. So it's an important covariate to consider. And then we have the pre-weaning period. So offspring have a 21-day gestation. At about 28 days, they're able to eat solid food and be independent from their mothers. So we wean them away from their mothers. And then we start assessing brain outcomes and behavioral outcomes. So we're looking at changes in DNA methylation and gene expression in the brain, but we're also interested in their behavioral outcomes. Okay. Now, what we also did, which was a little divergence from the actual human study, although perhaps it maps, in the end, it probably maps on a little bit better, is we used a lot of different doses of BPA, because not everyone is being exposed to the same dose. And if you get the records from the CDC on human exposures, there's quite a big range. Some people are, you know, eating out of canned soup all the time and getting very high levels of BPA, and some are eating fresh vegetables all the time, and so they're going to have lower levels of BPA. And so we exposed the mice to different doses, so 2, 20, and 200 microgram per kilogram. Now, when thinking and planning about the doses to use, we were very much aware of the fact that the current Environmental Protection Agency considered safe dose of BPA for human exposure is 40 micrograms per kilogram. So what we want to make sure is that we're exposing our animals to doses that were below the safe dose, because we're trying to challenge the idea that what is currently thought of as the safe dose is in fact safe for the developing brain. And then we chose a higher dose because, to be honest, we just wanted to make sure we got some sort of effect, and using the higher dose seemed a good way to do that. Okay. Now, when looking at the brain, we had a lot of brain regions to choose from. So this is just a schematic of the mouse brain. Unlike us, they have this huge olfactory bulb, and they have a fairly rudimentary cerebral cortex. But we wanted to look at the cortex because that was, in neuroimaging studies in humans, that's generally the brain region that's going to be imaged. So to draw some comparisons, we looked at the hippocampus because the hippocampus is a very kind of plastic brain structure. It's very important for learning and memory, but also for stress reactivity. And the hypothalamus, which is located here, because it is dense in hormone receptors. And BPA is an endocrine-disrupting chemical, and any kind of endocrine-disrupting chemical, if it's going to have an effect anywhere, it better have it in the hypothalamus because that's where all the receptors are. Okay, so we carried out the study and we looked at the gene expression in the brain. We always start with the gene expression before we move on to the epigenetic changes, because really the epigenetic changes are there to explain why we see differences in gene expression. If we don't see changes in gene expression, then we're in trouble. Okay, so this is a graph looking at relative level of gene expression in the four different conditions. We have the vehicle, the 2 microgram, the 20 microgram, and 200 microgram dose. And what became very clear is that we had very different dose response effects in terms of gene expression. So this is actually looking at estrogen receptor alpha in the hypothalamus. Now, estrogen receptor alpha seems to be, or is predicted to be, the target of bisphenol A, right? So that it may be having its effects through that receptor. And estrogen receptor alpha is very important because it's not a membrane-bound receptor. It actually is in the nucleus and is very important for turning genes on and off. It can bind directly to DNA and start the process of transcription. So estrogen receptors are important in and of themselves for their own signaling pathways, but also because they can regulate a lot of other genes. All right, so here's our male. So what happens? If we give them a vehicle, we have a nice sex difference, right? So actually males have less estrogen receptor alpha than females. And then you get this increase at the low doses and then a decrease at the higher doses. And you get the exact opposite pattern if you look at the females, which is the pink dotted line there. So we have a sex-specific effect, definitely. So males and females respond differently to their prenatal exposure to bisphenol A. And I should also mention, these gene expression changes are very long-term. So these are after they've been weaned from their mothers. So the exposure they had is restricted to while they were in fetal development. The changes in gene expression we're seeing are well after that, after they've been weaned from their mother. And what's also notable is that these are non-linear effects. So normally, if you give someone an increasing dose of something, you expect an increasing response, you know, relative to that dose. So the height, you'd expect the most effect at the highest dose and the least effect at the smallest dose. But that's not what you see here. And there has been speculation for a long time that endocrine disruptors can do this, that they have what are called non-monotonic dose response curves, where you get a curvilinear effect, in this case either a U-shape or an inverted U-shape. And this makes the whole issue of studying bisphenol A very complex, because let's say if you were to measure at this higher dose here, you might not see any effect at all. But actually, it's the lower dose effects that are having the most profound effects on gene activity, which makes setting a safe dose very problematic, because the safe dose might be safe, but doses lower than that might not be. And that's a big problem that we're tackling with. Now, this is just a graph to summarize all the different brain regions and all the different estrogen receptors that we looked at, because there's actually more than estrogen receptor alpha. There's estrogen receptor beta and gamma. And we looked at that in all three of our brain regions, in the cortex, the hippocampus, and the hypothalamus. And this table is actually just summarizing the sex difference in these genes, because there's a lot of now interest in how epigenetics actually contribute to the differences between males and females within the brain. That's not about, you know, possessing of a Y chromosome and the genes on that Y chromosome. There's actually a lot of epigenetic differences between males and females. And in the vehicle-treated condition, for all the estrogen receptors where we see an effect, males have less than females. If we give the low doses of BPA, we reverse that sex effect with now males having more receptors than females. And then when we get up into the higher dose in the 200 microgram, for the most part, we go back to our initial sex differences. So one thing that bisphenol A can do then is change the difference between males and females. And that's something that a lot of the human studies now are exploring. Now, in addition to estrogen receptors, which we think are probably an important way for bisphenol A to affect our biology, when we're thinking about epigenetics, one class of genes that's very important are those enzymes that add methyl groups to the DNA, the DNA methyltransferase. These are incredibly important. And what this table does actually is summarize what happens to a mouse if you delete the gene for the DNA methyltransferase. So we have different ones. So this one, DNMT1, is what's called a maintenance methyltransferase. When cells divide, it's the enzyme that goes around and makes sure that the DNA methylation pattern is reliably copied. If you delete this gene, you get, not surprisingly, genome-wide loss in methylation, embryonic lethality. So if the cells can't maintain their DNA methylation pattern, the individual won't survive. These other DNA methyltransferases are referred to as de novo methyltransferases because they add new methyl groups when triggered by various environmental events. And deleting these genes similarly leads to lethality. So you need these genes in order to change gene activity, and if you delete them, the organism won't survive. And what BPA, bisphenol A, seems to do is induce an effect very similar to what we saw with estrogen receptors on these enzymes. So we have a U-shaped curve with the female, an inverted U-shaped curve with the males. And this means, because these methyltransferases don't target a specific gene, they target the entire genome, we probably have gene expression changes throughout all of the genes within the genome. And this is something that we're looking at right now. Now,
is there a change in the methylation pattern in both hetero and euchromatin?
The methylation changes are probably specific to euchromatin because of the nature of the methyltransferase interaction with the DNA. But, you know, we tend not to look throughout the genome, mostly because it costs a lot of money. But we focus on target genes here. So most of the changes, and I'll show you some of the DNA methylation changes here, are localized to the promoter region of the gene, rather than elsewhere within the genome. And this again just summarizes the changes in the DNA methyltransferase. And again, we have males having less than females under the vehicle conditions, a reversal of those sex-specific effects at the low dose, and then kind of a normalization at the higher doses. So these DNA methyltransferases seem to be very much affected by bisphenol A exposure during pregnancy. Okay, what about DNA methylation? So we've got nice gene expression data. We're not going to run every dose because it's the assays for actually measuring DNA methylation are quite complex. So we're actually going to just choose one of the doses. In this case, we chose the 20 microgram because that seemed to have the most profound effect on gene expression. So we wanted to make sure we had very nice big group differences in gene expression before we start exploring DNA methylation. So this graph represents average level of methylation, so that's expressed as a percentage. And all of these little sites here, A1 through A11, are different cytosines within the genomic sequence of the estrogen receptor. Okay, so this is in the promoter region of the gene, not the coding region. What we see, if we look in the cortex of males, we find that there is increased methylation at several of these sites. If we look at the cortex of females, we see no effect. If we look in the hypothalamus of males, we see no effect. If we look in the female hypothalamus, we see increased DNA methylation in the vehicle relative to the treated dams. So we're seeing brain region-specific effects, sex-specific effects, and those sex-specific effects are going in different directions depending on what brain region you study. And what we don't really understand what this means for the kind of biology of BPA-induced effects, but it is very important because when we're studying humans, when we're trying to take this information and go back to humans, we can't take brain tissue, we can't take hypothalamus, we can't take cortex. We can't take your brain until you're dead. And what we can only rely on is the blood. And the problem is, if the brain is showing such specific reactions to BPA, with some brain regions showing this direction of effect and some brain regions showing quite another, what is the blood going to tell us? And this is a very big issue within kind of the translational nature of this work, is if we take blood and we measure DNA methylation patterns, what does it mean? So we don't know what the answer to that question is, but it's something that many groups are exploring. Okay, what happens to the behavior of these animals that have been exposed in utero to bisphenol A? Well, this is one behavior that we often look at mice. It's called allogrooming. It's when they groom others. This is like the social interaction of mice. They groom each other, they interact. And the more grooming they do of other individuals, the more social they tend to be in general. And what we see, in fact, is that the low doses of bisphenol A, we're actually seeing increases in sociality of these animals. And this finding is actually quite consistent with some work from other groups at the University of Virginia who've seen not only does this effect occur in this generation, so these are the individuals who are actually directly exposed in utero, but three generations down the line, you still see this effect with bisphenol A, low doses of bisphenol A actually increasing social behavior. So again, we don't know what that means for long-term kind of pathology and behavior, but certainly bisphenol A is having its persistent effects. If we look at aggressive behavior, so they are more social, but in fact, what we see is at the high doses of bisphenol A particularly, we see more aggressive behavior. And that's fairly consistent with the human data, where we're getting, certainly the males anyway, showing increased aggressive behavior if they've been exposed to high levels of BPA. You notice there's a little bit of suppression in aggressive behavior at the lower doses of bisphenol A, and that starts going up in the highest doses. Now, I mentioned that one of the factors that we considered when we were planning this experiment was the potential role of maternal care, right? So we always look at mothers and their interactions with their offspring during the postnatal period to determine whether that moderates the outcomes that we're interested in. And we looked at the way the mothers behave towards their offspring if they had ingested BPA during their pregnancy. Okay. And what we found is that two forms of rodent maternal care that are quite critical, how much they lick the pups and how much they nurse the pups, also varies depending on how much BPA you receive during pregnancy. So remember, these are adult females whose behavior is being modified by the level of BPA they are exposed to during pregnancy. And again, you get a little bit of a suppression in maternal behavior, and then an increase in maternal behavior at the highest doses of bisphenol A. And so one hypothesis, given the kind of dose effects of BPA on maternal care, would be that these prenatal exposures actually have long-term effects on offspring because they induce changes in the mother's behavior. And this, of course, is very interesting to the CDC and the EPA because they're interested, okay, well, if BPA does have an effect, is it the toxin itself? Is it exposure to the toxin, or is it the mother's exposure to the toxin that matters? And indeed, we see that maternal behavior, and I'll go over this in more detail in another model, has effects on gene expression. Some of them are sex-specific, much like BPA. So you can have BPA-inducing changes in gene expression. You can have maternal care-inducing changes in gene expression. So in most of these, so this is all our genes, all our DNA methyltransferases, and all our estrogen receptors, and all our three brain regions, we see, for the most part, increases in expression if you received high levels of maternal care. Now, what we can do then, because of the way that we designed this experiment, is then see statistically, if we factor in for the BPA-induced changes in maternal care, do we account for the effects of BPA on offspring development? So put more plainly, is maternal care the mediator of BPA-induced effects? And in fact, for most measures, it is not. BPA affects gene expression and behavior. Maternal care affects gene expression and behavior. But they do so, in a sense, in parallel. They don't. One doesn't account for the other, except for the effects on aggression and dominant behavior. So aggressive behavior, these BPA-induced effects on aggressive behavior, are completely accounted for by BPA-induced changes in maternal behavior. So it seems that it's not in utero exposure to the toxin, it's the toxin's effects on mothers and mother-infant interactions that actually induces the change in aggression that we see in the offspring. And this is something that we're going to explore, but I think it's probably an important thing to consider within any kind of experiment where we're trying to look at the pathways whereby an early life experience leads to epigenetic changes in the offspring. Now, that leads us to the postnatal period. And kind of a theme that has been very central to my work is looking at how variation in postnatal mother-infant interactions shape the brain. And I kind of highlighted that within the context of the BPA study. But variation in maternal care can have very, very profound effects. And we know this from epidemiological studies where there's been severe deprivation experienced in infancy, such as orphanage rearing, where children may have nutrients, they may get adequate sleep, but they get no social interaction, no interaction with a primary caregiver, no warmth from those caregivers. And of course, those infants display a lot of long-term problems in terms of behavior and neurobiology. Trying to model this question of the mechanisms whereby maternal deprivation can lead to such profound problems, Harry Harlow did some very seminal studies in the 50s and 60s where he took these little rhesus macaque monkeys and reared them without a mother. And of course, as you might suspect, they tend to have enormous behavioral problems. They're more stressed, they're less social. When they go on to care for their offspring and reproduce, they engage in a lot of abusive behaviors. And these kind of approaches are still being used, although it's considered unethical to rear animals with complete maternal deprivation. So what they do is they rear them with peers. And interestingly, it has pretty much the same effect. So it's not just social deprivation. It's being away from the mother in this case. Okay. This is the species that I spend most of my time working with. This is a Long Evans rat. And Long Evans rats have about 16 to 20 babies at a time. So they've got quite a lot of work to do. And what this female is doing right here is licking, grooming the pup. So I showed the graph of the licking, grooming changed by bisphenol A. And this is what it actually looks like. Now, we don't lick our babies, but licking, grooming in rodents is kind of a critical form of tactile stimulation. So they don't pick them up and hug them, but they do stimulate them. And they stimulate them by licking them. It helps them to become more behavioral active, as you see here, and cleans them and these in. And it also changes body temperature. And it actually has a lot very similar physiological effects as stroking infants, right? So studies in intensive care units in hospitals now provide a lot of tactile stimulation to premature infants because they know that tactile stimulation is so important for enhanced growth and neurodevelopment. Okay. As I said, there's a lot of variation in maternal care, even in the lab. So these are animals that are pretty genetically homogenous. They don't have the same kind of genetic variation that we do. And yet, they exhibit quite a lot of phenotypic variation in terms of maternal behavior. So this is licking grooming frequency of mothers, and this is actually a lot of mothers. I think there's about 400 in this cohort. And you can see there's a nice normal distribution. And so what we do as a methodological approach is we take mothers and offspring from this end of the distribution versus that end of the distribution. So we have our low licking grooming mothers and offspring and our high licking grooming mothers and offspring, and we compare them on various measures. And in this way, we explore the question, how does natural variation in maternal care shape the brain, and what is the role of epigenetics in that phenomenon? Now, these studies have been going on for about 15 years now. Initially, we started using this approach to explain why in the lab, where everything is very standardized and everyone's in the same environment, you still get individual differences in stress responsivity, right? So some individuals are more stressed than others. And as it happens, individuals who are very high in their stress responsivity tend to have mothers who provide very low levels of licking and grooming. Okay, so the less licking grooming you receive, the more reactive you are to stressors. If you receive low levels of licking grooming, you also have a decreased response to rewards. They tend to be a little bit more anhedonic. They don't like sugars and all sorts of things that most animals find rewarding. They do very poorly on learning and memory tasks. So if they try to learn something, they don't do it as well, and it takes quite a lot of trials to learn. And that may be related to the stress reactivity. If an individual is stressed, they have a lot of trouble learning something new. And some very interesting effects on social behavior that include actually more dominant behavior. Now, one of the outcomes that I'll focus on today is how the experience of high or low levels of this form of maternal care can shape the maternal care of the next generation, so of the females that experience that high or low licking grooming. So if your mother bestowed low levels of licking and grooming on you, you tend to be low in licking and grooming towards your own offspring. So there's a transmission from mother to daughter of this kind of variation in rearing behavior. And if you are reared by a high licking and grooming mother, you tend to be high in licking and grooming. So there's this nice transmission. And keep in mind that this is being done in genetically, you know, more or less identical animals. So this is not a genetic inheritance. And in fact, even if we do cross-fostering studies, where we take offspring born to a low-licking grooming mom and give them to a high-licking grooming mom versus vice versa, we find it's the nature of your experience during the postnatal period that predicts this outcome. It doesn't matter who you're born to. It matters what you experience during the rearing period. Okay. Now, then the question becomes mechanism. So how is it that we get from the experience of maternal care to the change in maternal behavior that offspring exhibit towards their own offspring? So in response to high levels of licking and grooming, what we know is that there's more oxytocin receptors. Oxytocin's, you know, the wonder drug now, because it increases trust, it makes people more social, it's heavily involved in maternal and reproductive behavior. And the tendency is the more oxytocin receptors you have, the more social and certainly the more maternal you are. If you receive high levels of licking and grooming, you are more sensitive to estrogen. So one of the realities of mammalian reproduction is that during pregnancy, you have very high levels of estrogens and other hormones that prime the brain, right? So many people are not that maternal until they go through pregnancy and give birth, and then they've got all these hormones priming the brain and increasing kind of maternal sensitivity to infant cues. And so estrogen sensitivity is very important for that whole pathway. And if you experience high levels of licking and grooming in infancy, you'll have heightened estrogen sensitivity when you're an adult and engaging in care towards your own offspring. And they have more estrogen receptor expression. So remember, these estrogen receptors are in the cell nuclei. They are turning genes on that have estrogen response elements built into their gene sequence. And the more estrogen receptors you have, the more sensitive you will be to estrogens, and typically the more oxytocin receptors can be made because of that estrogen sensitivity. And as a consequence of these kind of neurobiological changes, that for the most part are occurring in the hypothalamus of the brain, the more maternal sensitivity you have. Okay, what about epigenetics? So we saw that estrogen receptor expression, the transcription of that gene, was elevated in response to high levels of licking and grooming, and that effect persisted into adulthood. And we don't typically think of an experience in early life having that sustained an effect on the activity of genes unless something is maintaining it. And so that's what actually drove us to explore epigenetics. And as you might predict, hopefully based on what I've told you about what DNA methylation does, offspring that experience low levels of licking grooming during their early, very early stages of their postnatal development have more DNA methylation within the estrogen receptor alpha gene than those who experience high levels of licking grooming. So the low levels of licking grooming seem to lead to a shutting off of genes that are important for maternal behavior itself. This happens within the early postnatal period, and because DNA methylation can be such a persistent and a strong chemical bond, those effects persist well into adulthood when the females are engaging in care towards their own offspring. In contrast, the experience of high levels of licking grooming keeps the genes active and keeps them from being epigenetically silenced. And interestingly, we see a very similar pattern if we were to look at glucocorticoid receptors, which account for the differences in stress reactivity of individuals. So if you experience low levels of licking and grooming, you have higher methylation of the glucocorticoid receptor gene. As a consequence, you are less able to turn off your stress reactivity once it's initiated by a stressor. Okay. So maternal care and prenatal events seem to be capable of turning genes on and turning them off in the long term, right? So we have very profound neurobiological and epigenetic and behavioral effects of these early life experiences. And that those findings are now trying to be applied to a wider question about critical periods. So I focused on early life experiences because we have this conception that during early life, we are very plastic and changeable and sensitive to the environment. And as time rolls on, we get less sensitive. And that concept is captured in the concept of critical periods, where we have waves of sensitivity to environmental experiences, where different systems are at their kind of peak sensitivity to kind of input from the environment at different time points. And this is just from a kind of a summary paper thinking of how sensitivity changes over time. So you see periods of sensitivity in infancy and childhood. And you can see, for the most part, sensitivity starts declining in adolescence and is at a very low level in adulthood. However, epigenetics is allowing us to kind of rethink this kind of structured critical period notion, right? Because epigenetic changes are not genetic changes. They're not. They can be reversible, right? We can add methyl groups. We can take them off. We can add chemicals to histones. We can take them off. And if this sensitivity is being dictated by epigenetic phenomenon, which we think in large part they are, then what if we use some sort of intervention here that changes the epigenetic tone, that makes it more plastic, right? So a lot of people are doing this now in animal models, but it's really kind of opened up to new avenues of thinking about the question of reversibility or opening up periods of sensitivity to new learning in the context of, for example, psychotherapy, creating an environment that creates plasticity where you can intervene and change and restructure brain circuits is very attractive. And though I won't spend too much time on this example, this is kind of a really funny example to think about critical periods. So this is looking at the development of music preference in mice, all right? So mice tend to not like music. They like quiet, right? And for the most part, if any given mice, so this graph kind of summarizes it, these are naive mice that don't have any kind of experience with music. And the black bar indicates the number of individuals that prefer silence. So if they have a choice between spending time in two locations, they will go where there's quiet. And only a very small fraction actually will spend time with music. And this graph here is just kind of the illustration of the testing apparatus. So they have a silent chamber and a music chamber. And the mice can go wherever they like to spend their time. And they'll show a preference. Now, if you expose mice to music from postnatal day 15 to 24, more of them develop a music preference. And that's defined as the critical period for music preference. If you are exposed to music during that time period, that can shift many of the individual's preference towards music and away from silence. However, if the music exposure occurs after postnatal day 60, so that's into kind of the adolescent period of mice, then they don't shift, right? So music exposure doesn't shift their preference anymore. So we have a nice little window, a very narrow window, in which exposure to music can shift the behavior of individuals. So the authors of this study then said, okay, well, what if we do some epigenetic pharmacological therapies and see if we can open up the critical period later on in life and then shift music preference? And although this graph is a little bit complex, they did exactly what they had hoped to do. So here, these various lines are different treatment conditions, and this is the percent animals, and this is the preferences for silence. And in addition to epigenetic therapies, which I'll explain in a minute, they also had mice that had a mutation of the no-go receptor. So no-go receptors in the brain, as the kind of they're named very particularly because they can inhibit behavior. So no-go, when it's active, actually inhibits behavior. So if you get rid of the no-go gene, all of a sudden individuals are less inhibited and their brains are more plastic. So we have VPA is the pharmacological treatment which can change those histone tails and make the chromatin and the DNA more active. And so these are the no-go receptor guys if they've been exposed only to quiet. And they love the quiet. So 100% of them are quiet preferring. However, if you expose them to music, all of a sudden they all like the music. Even though they've been exposed to it outside of their critical period, now they're much more plastic and much more amenable to a preference for music. The same effect induced through a genetic change is induced by valproic acid treatment. Now, valproic acid is a treatment that has been used for many, many decades for bipolar disorders and for seizures. Okay, but actually, one of its primary molecular mechanisms is to change histone tails and to add acetyl groups to histones and make the DNA more active. So if you treat individuals with a compound that makes their DNA more active, more epigenetically active, you can actually open up a new critical period for learning, and these individuals can learn music preference. So this is, you know, a very attractive model now for looking at a number of other critical periods that we know to exist, for example, in the visual system and other systems. Okay. So our new understanding of epigenetics is giving us new insights into the plasticity that exists within the brain. So our brains are far more changeable, even beyond those early prenatal and postnatal events, and epigenetics and targeting epigenetic changes may be one way to change the adult brain. And there's a lot of work, as I mentioned, on learning and memory. So whenever you learn something new, there's an epigenetic alteration in your brain that is, in a sense, responsible for the long-term change in memory of that event. But I would also point out that this is a very new area of science, and so I think it's potential has not actually been realized because we're learning so much that we didn't know, both about genetics and how DNA works, but also about how biology works and how the nuclei and events within the nuclei of cells interact with what's going on in the broader context of the brain. Okay, now the last issue and kind of evolving theme that I'll talk about today is that of inheritance. And there has been, I'd say, decades of work showing that grandparents' experience can affect change that lasts well beyond their offspring's generation into the next generation. And the question has always been, well, what is the mechanism of that transmission? When it comes to human studies, in which this is demonstrated, people will often say, oh, it's because of cultural transmission or social learning. It's not about you know, some sort of inherited biological change, because that would bring up Lamarck, and that would upset people. So we don't want to do that, but we want to understand a little bit more about the biology of the transmission of traits. Now, in the context of what I've told you about how mother-infant interactions can shape the mothering behavior of their offspring, what we seem to be seeing is the fact that early life experiences can lead to long-term epigenetic changes in the brain. So this is a coronal section through the brain, and this is the hypothalamus right here. And because of those epigenetic changes, there's a recapitulation of maternal behavior from one generation to the next. You can have a very, very reliable transmission of maternal behavior that isn't really about learning a maternal style. So the offspring aren't learning, oh, I should lick because that's nice. Their brain is changing in response to the licking, and that brain change is shutting off genes that they would need to engage in high levels of maternal behavior, so they can't. So the social learning, in a sense, is not learning an act, but it's your brain responding to the stimuli that you experience during infancy. Now, unlike a genetic inheritance, this is very much dictated by what your experience is during development. So this is an example of a study that we did. So we took offspring born to low or high-licking grooming moms, and we knew what that would predict in terms of their maternal behavior, but we decided to mix things up a bit, and we put them into juvenile environments. So after they were taken from their moms and they were independent and they were able to eat on their own, we put them into impoverished environments or standard environments or enriched environments. Standard laboratory environments for rodents are pair housing, so social housing in a cage, but they don't have toys or anything like that. Impoverished was a social isolation, which is a very, very harsh thing for most social animals. And we have enriched conditions in which they have both the social and toys and running wheels and all sorts of fun things. So we've altered their environment, and then we look at how they develop. So if we look at their maternal behavior, if you are born to a low-licking grooming mom, but then you're put in an enriched environment, you become a high-licking grooming mom. So your later life experience actually shifts your maternal behavior. If we take the offspring of a high-licking grooming dam and put them in an impoverished environment, they become a low-licking grooming dam. So nothing is set in stone just because you experience, you know, variation in rearing conditions early on. Later life experiences, particularly if they're very extreme, like impoverishment versus enrichment, can actually shift maternal behavior quite significantly. And importantly, these effects can be passed on to the next generation, because what matters is what you experience. And what these grand offspring will experience is the maternal care that their mothers provide to them, which may be altered from what they were provided with during infancy because of these other life experiences. So environmental transmission, these kind of epigenetic transmissions through maternal care, for example, are very susceptible to changes over generations depending on shifts in maternal care induced by various environmental experiences. So if I took high-licking grooming females and I prenatally stress them, they would likewise become low-licking grooming mothers. So we can mess around and shift with this inheritance, which makes it a lot more plastic and flexible than genetic inheritance. Now, within the context of epigenetics, there has been two ways of thinking about the inheritance of epigenetic information. The first is the example that I've already shown you, where maternal care is inducing an epigenetic change in the brain, where that's inducing changes in maternal behavior of the offspring, which then goes on to change epigenetics in the brain of the next generation, right? So because of maternal care, we have epigenetic changes that are also being transmitted across generations. This is in contrast to perhaps the more traditional way of thinking of inheritance, where information goes through the germline, right? So our oocytes and sperm bring genetic information to the offspring, which is combined, and they pass on variants of that information to the next generation. But what's becoming clear, and perhaps is the most speculative but interesting areas of epigenetics, is that it might also be possible for epigenetic information to get within those germ cells and to be passed across generations. And when this happens, you don't need to recapitulate some experience. So an experience in one generation induces an epigenetic change, and that is observed in the next generation and the generation after that, even in the absence of exposure. So let's say if bisphenol A could induce those effects, which we think it actually does, bisphenol A in utero affects epigenetic changes in the sperm of these offspring who've been exposed in utero. That change is inherited by offspring and grand offspring of that individual. Now, most of this germline inheritance work has been studied in fathers. And the reason why that is because within mammals, it's so hard to dissociate the kind of context of development, the mother, and our development occurs within the oocyte and within the uterus and within the context of maternal care from the actual epigenetic information that might be passed through the germ cells. In males, it's a little easier because in most species, fathers don't provide any kind of postnatal care for offspring. So in mammals, only about 3 to 5% of males actually participate in the care of offspring, but they do pass on, obviously, their sperm and possibly their epigenetic information. So some very interesting work being done on this topic is looking at exposure to pesticides, so in particular vinclozolin, which is used particularly on grapes as a pesticide. And Michael Skinner and his colleagues in the University of Washington have exposed pregnant females to this toxin and found epigenetic changes in the offspring of that female, the grand offspring, and even the great-grand offspring, and associated with a number of health effects as well. So it seems that a one-time exposure can induce an epigenetic change that might be transmitted, much like DNA, to the next generation. For rats?
Oh, it's rats.
Yeah, sorry. No, it wouldn't be ethical. Although we do it as a society, but we don't actually plan it and get funding for it. So.
Sure, rats,
yeah, sorry. Yeah, those are the rats. And now there is evidence from all sorts of realms of human and animal work showing that a number of fathers' exposures, stress, drug use. There's some really interesting work on cocaine now, so father's exposure to cocaine prior to mating in male rats predicts epigenetic changes in offspring. Smoking, nutrition, social experience, and so on. The experience of father seems to become heritable, right? So, and it's thought that this involves epigenetic change. So I'll highlight some of the kind of social experiences that might become heritable. So this is looking at early life maternal separation. So males, when they're developing, are separated from their mothers repeatedly during development. So this study's done in mice. So we've got our F1 males. Those are the guys that were exposed to maternal separation. We mate them with a female who was not exposed to maternal separation, and they have offspring. Now, the poor females have increased anxiety-like behavior and increased depressive-like behavior. The males are fine behaviorally, but if you mate them with a female, their offspring display behavioral abnormalities predicted by the previous generation's experience. If we look a little later on in life, just to illustrate how plastic we are throughout the lifespan, if we expose adults to adults' chronic stress, so this is in mice again, and was done by kind of varying the social environment constantly, which is very stressful for animals because they like to develop nice, stable hierarchies. We take males that are exposed to stress, we mate them, we get offspring. The poor females here have increased anxiety and social deficits. The males don't have any behavioral deficits, but they can pass on the deficits to the next generation. So findings like these have led people to suspect, well, maybe epigenetic phenomenon are not just heritable during cell divisions, but they're actually heritable from one generation to the next. And this goes counter to the existing dogma in biology that only your DNA is passed on to the next generation. So we have this idea that any kind of epigenetic changes that accumulate within the germ cells, the oocyte, or the sperm are wiped clear at the time of fertilization or just after fertilization. But now it's becoming increasingly clear that that's not the case. So what we think is happening is that environmental exposures are inducing epigenetic variations in the sperm that after fertilization, which does indeed erase a lot of this kind of epigenetic baggage from our genome, some is left. So you can, you know, think of how many base pairs you have in your DNA, and even if only 10% of those retain that kind of epigenetic information, that's a lot of cytosines that have a memory of the past. So we have most being erased, but some staying on in the zygotes, so the newly formed individual. And then those marks are maintained in all the tissues of the offspring, right? Because they're there from day one. They're there from the one cell stage. All cells emanating from that cell will have that same epigenetic baggage. And this will affect a number of outcomes. And because they're present in the germline tissues, the cells that go on to make the sperm or egg, they will be passed on to the next generation. And so if we go back to our maternal separation example, and we look at methylation. So now we're looking at methylation of a specific gene. This is MECP2. This is a protein that binds to methylated DNA. So it's very important within epigenetic processes. If we take males that have been exposed to maternal separation and compare them to control males, we find that in the sperm, they have higher methylation levels within this gene. If we look in their offspring in the brain, we see the same epigenetic pattern that seems to be inherited by the offspring. And there's more and more examples of this kind of inherited epigenetic variation across generations. Now, trying to figure out the exact mechanisms through which this occurs is very challenging. And one issue that's come up, and certainly my lab has been very interested in this, is whether females might be contributing to this paternal effect, right? So I'm going to show you why we suspect this to be the case. So here we've got a male. He's experienced social stress. So he's been defeated and beat up by another male, which isn't very nice. So he's very stressed. We made him with a control female. This is work that's actually done at Mount Sinai on the east side. And their offspring have a number of problems, right? So increased social avoidance, increased anxiety, and increased depression. If we use IVF, which is one way to kind of get rid of some of the potential maternal effects that might be occurring to induce these females. So if we take the sperm and we fertilize an egg of a control female with that kind of stressed sperm, we don't get all the phenotypes. We only get the depressed behavior, which suggests that something that the mothers are doing is actually part of that transmission of these paternal effects across generations. So that's something that we're looking at and that might be very interesting. I should also note that IVF has huge epigenetic effects on offspring. And there's increasing concern that the way in which this procedure is being conducted, even in humans, may be leading to increased incidences of epigenetic disorders. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up there, but I want to bring it back to Lamarck, because this is a lot of this work has gotten people very, very upset, because the one thing you learn in biology is that Lamarck is wrong, Darwin is right, and there is no inheritance of acquired characteristics. But I think it's very important to keep in mind that actually, Darwin and the thinking of how inheritance worked during Darwin's time is very different to what we think about it as inheritance. So they had no conception of how DNA worked and these kind of things. But I think certainly in the advent of all these new epigenetic methods and science, there is evidence that traits can be transmitted across generations, that our experiences can become incorporated into our biology and affect the next generation. Now, Lamarck and other Lamarckians theorized that this would occur to give that next generation an advantage, right? What's better than to prepare you for the environment you will exist in than transmitting information from your parents? And in many cases, in some of the animal work I showed, there seems to be a good suspicion that that's what these epigenetic changes are doing, is they're preparing offspring for a particular kind of environment. Now, you might think low levels of maternal care, how can that possibly be adaptive or better prepare offspring? But what I didn't tell you is that offspring that get low levels of maternal care are also very highly sexually receptive. So the two traits come as a pair. And under stressful environments, for most mammals, being able to reproduce young and reproduce a lot is going to enhance the survival of your offspring better than providing them with more maternal care. Whereas in kind of low stress, high resource environments, perhaps having better cognitive skills as a function of high maternal care would be better for survival. Now, there is evidence, as I mentioned, there's all this evidence that a variety of paternal exposures can have these transgenerational effects. And we also know that a variety of environmental exposures can induce epigenetic variation. And these can range from kind of traditional biological exposures like hormones and drugs and pesticides, what we eat, very big predictor of epigenetic variation. But these can also include more psychosocial experience, the stress you experience. There's a lot more work being done on kind of the cognitive way that you perceive the world and discrimination and how this comes to encode itself epigenetically. And what's interesting is all of these, regardless of what kind of domain of experience it is, they all seem to act through a common pathway, and that's through the change in activity of genes. So whether you're dealing with nurturing or drug use, it all boils down to these molecular changes within the cell that are controlling what genes are active, what genes are not, and that turns on or turns off various neural circuits. Okay. One issue within epigenetics that I think will be very interesting in the coming years is increasing our understanding of the concept of plasticity versus stability. So I talked about critical periods, which is kind of the definition of stability in a sense, and lack of plasticity after a certain time point. But we're really just trying to understand now, under what conditions would plasticity occur, and under what conditions would stability occur? This kind of duality of epigenetics is what kind of caused a great kind of sluggishness in the field about 10 years ago, because if epigenetics are what create your cell character, what makes your neuron different from a blood cell, do you really want that to be plastic? Right? So do you really want some of these very important epigenetic changes to occur in response to whether you had a bad day or whether you ate, a high-fat diet? Probably the answer is no. But we don't understand right now under what conditions plasticity versus stability would occur. And that's something that we need to understand better if we're going to understand how we can use this information to better inform learning and memory paradigms and interventions. So finally, I'll say that changes to the epigenome are one way in which the environment can come to embed itself within our genome. So we have this cellular memory of an environmental event. And when that occurs within an organism, certainly when it occurs within the brain, it can induce long-term changes in behavior and create those kind of unique characteristics that we have. And so at the end of the day, our genetic variation is very slight compared to another individual's genetic information. But our epigenetic profiles are very, very divergent. And so if we're thinking about what contributes in a very large way to our unique characteristics, epigenetics is probably a broader way to think about how that's being achieved. Although I should note that your epigenetic variation is in large part determined by your genetic code, because where a cytosine is determined by your DNA sequence. So important to keep that in mind. But I think what this has really opened up is a new origin, a new era of research on the study of unique characteristics and getting away from nature versus nurture to think about how how environmental experiences become embedded in our biology and kind of the common pathways through which our DNA and environmental experiences come to shape our behavior. And I think with that, I will stop. And if there's time, I'd love to answer questions.
Okay.